everyone, and welcome to the Her Journey Told podcast. On this show, we will focus on strengthening women's mental fitness through sharing the joy, struggle, and wisdom of each woman's journey. Our show is powered by Pivotal Moments. Go to pivotalmoments.org to learn more. Hello, and welcome to the Her Journey Told podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Pivotal Moments Media. I'm your host, Sandy Lutton. And I'm so excited and truly humbled to have Lori Burns and Peter Olson with me today. Welcome, guys.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
From all around the world, too. We've got Peter in Hong Kong, Lori in LA, right?
Orange County, but close enough.
Orange County. And I'm in DC. So we're spread all over the place. But I'm truly thankful to have you guys here. Lori Burns is a philanthropist and very successful entrepreneur and author of Punished for Purpose, and has done some really, truly incredible things. And then Peter Olson is also a philanthropist and been a very successful entrepreneur, and both have really found their passion in life by giving back based on what they've learned and how they grew up. So Lori, I was hoping you could just give us a little bit of your background, because if I think both of your stories are so compelling, and the fact that the two of you met and your lives intersected is not a mistake. And I just think it's so brilliant and so amazing. So I really need for everyone to hear this story. But if you could kind of just jump in and tell us where you came from and how you got here and became the founder of the Teen Project.
Okay, so I grew up in an abusive home, and I ended up in foster care about the age of 13, which was pivotal for me because I grew up Jewish. So 13 is supposed to be a time when you're like solidifying your existence with God. And instead, I was solidifying the fact that God hated me, because my father's abuse got discovered on me, and I got put in a ward for the criminally insane because he hid a handgun and told everyone that I had it and called the police, and I was taken away. And shortly after that, I was in the foster care system. I'm giving you the shorter version, because
sure,
or else I'd take up the full hour. So I ended up in the foster care system, and I really just tumbled down through the system and hit every branch. Like, if you know anything about foster kids, I was the one that hit every statistic possible. I was addicted. By the time I was 16, I was shooting up. And by the time I was 18, I was homeless after foster care. And I ended up with nowhere to go, which I didn't realize at the time was the expected result for foster kids. I just thought I had bad luck. So I was addicted and homeless, and I ended up working the streets as a prostitute because it was all I had just to make it in life. So I was on the streets for many years, and I lost my daughter while I was on the streets, and I was almost killed one night. I had been on the streets for many years, but I was almost killed by some gang members that had taken me into the woods with the plan of raping me and killing me. And the night I was almost killed, I was 23 years old, and I actually begged that they would kill me because I didn't think I had anything left to save. My life had been one tragedy after another, and I had been suicidal. We have an extra guest here.
That's okay.
I had been suicidal for quite some time, and at this point in my life, there was nothing left to live for as far as I was concerned. And I begged for them to kill me, but instead of ending up dead, what happened was they beat me really bad and left me in the canyon. And a stranger saved my life that night, a man that I didn't know, and took me to a hospital. And I was able to get a place to stay from a man that used to visit me on the streets and try and help me. And then I got into a women's treatment center, and I ended up staying there a year. And my own daughter went to foster care that year. And after a year of sobriety, and what was really important for me in that year was talking about all those bad things that happened to me as a kid, because I wouldn't have made it without letting go of all the horrific things that had happened and finding some way to find peace with it. And then I got out of the home, the recovery home, and I got a job. And I struggled with getting a job because I didn't have any marketable skills, I guess you would say, besides the ones that weren't legal. So I started working in the computer industry, and I wasn't very good at it at first, but I started to get better and better. And I got my daughter back from foster care. And then I started a meeting at my house. I go to a lot of sobriety meetings, you know, so that I can stay sober. And I was scared if I didn't start a meeting at my house, then I wouldn't go. So I started the meeting at my house, and 1 week, a woman that I didn't know came to my house with the other women that were usually there and said that she had a daughter that was 12 and she couldn't get help because she couldn't leave her daughter at the drug dealer's house. And at that point in my life, I felt like I'd been so blessed. I was only 25 years old. And I had my own daughter back. I had a little part-time job at a computer place. So I offered to take her daughter and help her. And that would be the first, when I first took this kid, let me just say it this way. When I took this kid in and I told her mom she could get help, her mom was supposed to come back in a month and she didn't come back. Mm-hmm. And I ended up with this kid and I found out that the mom went back to the streets. So I applied to be a foster mom so I could keep the kid until her mom came back. And they denied me because I had all kinds of prostitution stuff on my records. And they said, if you get 7 years clean and sober, you can come back and reapply. And I was devastated because I had been through so much as a kid. Here I was with a kid in my own care. And my only choice was to do the same thing to her they did to me. So I was able to get guardianship of her so they wouldn't put her through the system, which was a great thing. And then her mom ended up dying of a drug overdose. But what happened was God kept on bringing abused children into my life over and over and over again. Turns out 7 years later, I got my nephew at my house and he's about to go in the foster care system. He was 4 and I was so pissed off. I went to apply to be his foster mom and they said, it's been over 7 years. We're going to make you a foster mom. What I didn't realize is they were making me a foster mom for any kid. I thought they were making me a foster mom to get my nephew. So the floodgates opened at that point and I started taking in foster kids. And today I think I'm up to number 43, but I was waking up at 3:00 in the morning and it was a problem because Northrop was an hour from home. So it was a commute and waking up at 3:00 in the morning. So I started struggling. I thought the sprinklers were turning on in the backyard. They weren't. And I started sharing about it at meetings because I'd forget what I was talking about all the time. And a man told me that the American Indians say the spirits talk the loudest at 3:00 in the morning, that it's the time when the veil between our world and the spiritual world is the thinnest. And if you're waking up at 3:00 in the morning, you should start to pray about it. And I started to think, oh, my God. And I always thought, I used to tell my sponsor, I feel like God saved my life in that canyon road with those bad gang members for a reason. And she would always say, well, you've got all these kids, Lori. And I would always say, those kids are like my brothers and sisters. Like they're like my children. This is how I met my first family when I was 13 in that group home. These were the first people I ever bonded to. So I felt like God saved my life for something more. So I started putting notes in my God box. I had a little wooden box when things were driving me nuts. I'd put notes in it. But I actually didn't believe in it's not that I didn't believe. Let's correct that. I believed in the big God, but I thought he was out to get me. So I thought if I start praying to him, my radar is going to turn on like ET phone home. He's going to find me and all the shit's going to come down again, you know, all the bad stuff. So I decided not to pray to that God. And I prayed to George Burns because he played God in a movie.
Right.
I had Notes to George, which is a book that I'm working on right now. Hopefully it'll be done by Christmas. But I started writing notes to George, like, why are you waking me up at 3:00 a.m? I need my sleep. Like, what do you need me to know? And then I made a determination that in order to know God's will for me, I had to say yes to everything that came my way so I could figure out why I'm waking up at 3:00 a.m. So I got invited to a class on how to build a boys town. And I always loved this boys town place down the street from me. So I was really excited about that. Actually, if you ever look through my emails, you'll see the word boys town going on since like 2001. So I was obsessed a little with the place. So I took a class on that. And then the next thing I know, I'm invited to the foster care advisory board, which is the board that serves all of the kids in the county, and only 2 or 3 foster parents even serve on it. And I thought it was funny that they denied me at first for being a prostitute. Now they wanted me on the board, but I think it was because I was doing better with the really hard cases, right? Mm. So they wanted to know what I was doing. And it was on that foster care advisory board the first day that a couple of men came into the meeting late, all disheveled, and they said, they reported to the group, which is probation officers, judges, social workers. They reported we were following three kids that left foster care and we lost them. So we don't have anything to report. And then as if it was just nothing, they said, but don't worry, we'll find three more kids and start again next month. And in my mind, I'm like, wait, I'm thinking, but I'm not saying out loud because I'm by my nature of being brought up in the foster care system, I feel very scared in a room with a bunch of probation officers and social workers and judges. But I'm thinking, what, you lost them and nobody's asking what happened. Did they die? What do you mean you lost them? Are they gone forever? There's no finding them. We're just going to pick three more. And I went home and I Googled the word emancipation, which was what he was talking about. And that's when I realized that 65% of foster kids would be homeless on their 18th birthday. And I was so upset. I called my friend Linda crying. And I said, Linda, you've got to Google the word emancipation. And then she started crying. And she said, Lori, what are we going to do? And I'm like, well, I don't know what we're going to do, but everybody else is doing nothing. So we have to do something. So I had heard about a place called LegalZoom where you could apply for anything legal. So I got in there and I did charity paperwork and we were going to start charity. We didn't know what to call it. We kept it when Linda and I would talk about it. And then we had a bunch of volunteers following us. We would say, you know, that team project thing we're working on. So one of the volunteers said, why don't you just call it the team project? Because you're always calling it the team project. So I said, okay, we'll call it the team project and we'll start the charity. And we didn't really know what we were doing. A bunch of my girlfriends and I got together to write grants and we sat down at my kitchen table. We didn't know what we were doing. We were Googling like grant this, grant that. And our first big grant we ever sent for, we were all Googling grants and reading to each other what the application said. There was one page that had a really cute cowboy on it. So we turned it around, we all looked at it. And we said, okay, that's the one we're going to apply for. That's about as good as it got for us. So we applied for that grant, but we had gotten small donations immediately, like 20, 10. We had $400 on our way to the bank and we cried all the way there. And the next thing you knew, that cute cowboy that we applied with, it was a couple of days. It's really weird because I'm Jewish and a lot of weird stuff happens. Good stuff happens around Christmas. I can't figure that one up. But we were shopping for dresses at the mall and I got a call from a lady and she said, Lori, we received your application to our family foundation for $100,000. That was a cowboy grant. And I said, yeah. And she said, well, it's the end of the year and we have extra money to give away. Do you mind taking $125,000?
Wow.
So I started crying and I said, no, I don't think we mind at all. And that would be our first house. So it was right after that we found a little 3-bedroom house and a bunch of volunteers were following us and they saw the 3-bedroom house and there was a bunch of people in construction and they knocked it down and built up a brand new 6-bedroom house. And it was amazing. So we were starting to get girls off the street that had been dumped on the street without any hope for their future and they had completely given up on their futures, right? And around that time, I got asked to speak in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And that's where I met Peter. And at that point, we had a bunch of girls in the house that had dreams that maybe someday they could be something that they wanted to be. And there was a little girl named Chelsea who, when she got taken out of her dad's care, when the police took her, she made sure to take this little article she had about a place called FITM, Fashion Institute of Design mm-hmm. and Merchandising. And it was a little newspaper thing that she crumpled up and stuck in her pocket. And she'd carried it with her from the orphanage to the place she lived next to my home. And when we brought her into the team project house, she still had that crumpled piece of paper with FITM. And FITM's kind of expensive. You know, we didn't know how we were going to recreate all these dreams. And it was at that time I was at, and that's just where the journey begins, because there's a lot after that. I was in Arizona speaking and someone said to me when I was done, there's a man looking for you right now. His name's Peter. We looked all over. We couldn't find him. But we finally got with Peter and Peter said, I want to help you. Turns out Peter's donation at that time paid for Chelsea to go to school. And wow. Chelsea became an amazing artist. She worked at BCBG and some other big design firms when she grew up. But Peter and I, our story went on after that because Peter read my book. Mm-hmm. And in my book, I talk about my box with notes to George. And Peter, I decided, you know, it would be great to give everyone the chance to have a box, especially little kids that are abused, where they could put their notes. And Peter donated, I believe it was 5,000 God boxes. I still have a few in my garage right now. And everywhere I go to see an abused kid, I have a box. And one of my newer books called Sanctuary of the Heart has a story of a little girl that was in a group home. And I came and spoke there, and she was so scared, she ran to her room afterwards. She wouldn't talk to me. And I told the staff, give her this God box. And I gave them a God box, and they brought it to her room with my phone number on it. Turns out 4 years or so later, she's homeless, and she had memorized my phone number. So she called it because she had it in her God box, and she works for us. She's one of our staff. She went through our program as a kid. And she grew up and she now works for us. Her name's Apple, and her story's in that book. But amazing. Peter went on to continue to donate. And what happened was, let me see, after that, we started some program where any kid in the nation could text the word shelter in their zip code to a short code and get to a home. And then I found a bunch of homeless kids in Venice Beach, and some man gave me a building out there, and we opened a place for kids out there. And then I met two men. One was a billionaire and the other one was an actor, and they both wanted to do a 100-bed facility, and they asked me to help them. And these kind of God shots are in my book. God shots, you know, things I can't explain, stories of synchronicity. So I helped them. I said, I'll do your corporate paperwork, I'll get your website going, and I'll find your building. And one man wanted a warehouse and the other man wanted a treatment center. So they couldn't agree. I said, I'll just look at both till you guys agree on something. I found a warehouse connected to a treatment center within 3 weeks, both were leased. So amazing. I signed a $25,000 lease on both of them. And one man got seriously ill and the other man just completely backed out. So I had a $25,000 a month lease that I signed. And I don't have $25,000 a month, with a warehouse and a treatment center. And around that time, another man read my book and made $1 million donation for me to quit my job. And I started running that place. And we helped thousands of kids. And about the same time, Peter gave a donation for the warehouse, which had sat empty forever. And that warehouse is now a critical care hospital for girls in need. After Peter did that, we got a $50 million grant to open that up into a hospital. But I got to tell you, the most magical story is, when I started the charity, when I first started the charity, and before we found that house, that 3-bedroom house, I stood on a hill, and I have a video of it somewhere, and my hair was blowing all over. It was a windy day, and I told a bunch of volunteers, I want to build a place like Boys Town, because I've been obsessed with Boys Town since I was little. And the reason why is it was beautiful homes. It was the kind of homes normal people live in. They were 4,000 square foot homes, 5 of them, on a hill called Flanagan Road, after Father Flanagan. It's at the top of a peak. You could see all the way down through the valley. One of them has a huge swimming pool in the back. And all of the houses emitted love, and the kids were happy. So I always wanted to create a place like that. And when I pointed to the place, one of the construction guys said, you can't afford that. Lori, you've got 100,000. Those are millions. So I bought the little house. But fast forward to about 2018, serving on the foster care advisory board, Boys Town goes, I don't know, belly up. They still have their original place in Nebraska. I think it's Nebraska, but the rest of the places are closed. They closed New York, Arizona, Texas, California. So, when I saw that those huge homes went closed, I can't afford to buy them. I started posting it that someone would please buy them. And turns out an investor bought them, which is what I was fearing. Right. So all the foster kids that lived there went back to the orphanage, and some guy's going to flip them and make a buttload of money off of them. Right. And I was pissed. So I just kind of put it out of my mind. It wasn't God's will. And I went on a convention to, I think it was Canada. And that's where I saw Peter. And Peter said, Lori, how's the charity doing? And I said, great, Peter. And he said, and he'll tell you more about how he said it. But he told me that he was going to give me some money. I'm going to leave that for Peter to say it. And I said, thank you, Peter. It was a very big amount of money. And when I got back home, I'm going to tell you what happened, but I'm going to let Peter talk first.
So Peter, take us back just a little bit. Can you hear me? Yeah. Take us back just a little bit, because I am still just fascinated by how your stories are so interconnected and you experience so many of the same things. So tell us, you've shared with me, but just bring us up to speed on how you ended up in Hong Kong and, you know, born in London, and bring us up to speed.
Okay. I'm just an ordinary working class stiff from London, and we had a lot of slums in London. I was born in the Second World War. And one of the things that I remember with much love is when my mother told me, it was a period in World War II when the Germans were throwing over V2 rockets, and they just landed. There was no pilot or anything. They were just thrown into London. They made a howl. And when the howl stopped, it meant they were going to land indiscriminately, and where they were going to land in residential areas. And my mother told me that she heard this air raid warning, and she ran out with me in her arms and looked up, and there was a V2 rocket coming straight through our front door. And she laid me on the ground, it cut, there was no sound, and she lay on top of me to protect me, and it landed in the next street. And that's what I remember about my mum. That's what I remember about mum, her unconditional love, the only real love that I had. And of course, my mum had to die. And she had to die after a bad life. You know, I was the product of a Jewish father and a Roman Catholic mother. And I was a Jew until I was 12. And you suffered. There's a lot of anti-Semitism in the UK then. You know, you're a Jew boy, you're this, you're that. And I used to fight like hell. Then I go to the synagogue when I'm 12 to arrange a bar mitzvah, and the rabbi says, no, you're not a Jew, you're a Catholic. Take your mother's religion. So I'm okay with that because, of course, I'm a father. My father was a man that beat the shit out of my mother. He was a crook, a criminal. He dumped us when we were 15 and we were homeless. And I had to start to go to work, and I was very good at sport. And the things that my father did give me, if he gave me nothing else, was a love of music and a love of sport. And I left school when I was 16. I left school when I was 16, and I earned about $15 a week, and I struggled. But it didn't bother me. You know, that was what life was like. I was different from all of my contemporaries and all my peers at school. Obviously, I'm not playing with the dog, boy. So I went to work, and my mother died. And we were homeless, and I went to live with an aunt, and I was told I was useless. I was told, you're no good. Forget all these big dreams of yours. I fought a war for you, son. You'll be lucky if you get a semi-detached house and a couple of kids and a wife and a nice Ford car. And that's all I really wanted and I expected. But I believed that I was useless. I took it in, and my belief in my being useless led to me being sacked from my first 7 jobs. And I just couldn't seem to fit in. I was frightened. I would go to an interview. I would seize up. I could mumble. I could hardly talk. I'd meet a girl that I wanted to go out with, and I'd seize up. I just had this fear and this kind of rejection about everything. And coming to my 20s, and I met a woman that I fell in love with. I found a job at last that I could do, which was with a toy company called Matchbox. And I found that I wasn't useless. I found that I had talent. And they asked me in 1972 if I would go to Hong Kong and open up. And I was terrified. I'd never been to Hong Kong. I was absolutely scared, stiffless. And I said, yes. Took me, what have I got? My life savings, $150. I'm 28 years old. I washed my daughter and my son in the sink. No hot water, we no bathroom, we share a toilet with other families. What have I got to lose? Stiff upper lip, Peter, get out there. So when I went out there, I was known in slang of what Brits use as filth, F-I-L-T-H, failed in London, try Hong Kong. And I went out and I found my talent. I found that I could negotiate with some of the richest people in the world. There's a guy called Lee Cushing. I negotiated with him over a toy called Screaming Demons. And I won the negotiation and I was honest, which was a rare thing for buyers in Hong Kong. And I started to do very well. And then my next stage was to become a Lombard, L-O-M-B-A-R-D, which is lots of money, but a right dork. And I started to make money. I opened my own business. Again, I was terrified and I built my business up. First year's turnover was 90,000 US and I built it up to about 95 million US. And I thought, this is incredible. I now live in a house with 6 bedrooms, 4 bathrooms. I got 3 cars and everything. And I thought, this is it. I've made it. All those doubters. And inside me, there was this hole. And inside me, my marriage was going down the tubes because I traveled a lot and it made my wife insecure and we argued. My customers drove me mad. Everyone's trying to cheat me. So you drive me mad. And I was told, you know, Peter, here's your philosophy in business. Screw them before they screw you. And it became like that and it became a battle. And I was very unhappy because by nature, I'm quite a nice kid. And so I've got a bank full of money. I've got a portfolio full of assets and my soul is running on empty. And one day someone offered me a line of cocaine when I was 52 years old and never done drugs before. I took the line of cocaine and within 6 months I was addicted. And during the next 5 years, I was doing 5 grams of cocaine a day and any other drug that you could think of, any other drug, speed, marijuana, hashish, anything I would take. And my life was spiraling out of control and my family found out, my wife left me, the family left me and I was broken. And then all the friends and the people that had respected me and dined on my credit card out here said I was a disgrace and turned their back on me. And I don't know what to do about it. And then the third decision that I really made, the second decision was to do drugs. The third decision was to say, I got to stop. And I'm living in this 6-bedroom house with 4 bathrooms and I'm on my own. And I wake up one morning in the fetal position and it was like, God, please help me. I said, most difficult thing in the world, 3 most difficult words for a drug addict is, I need help. And I said, I need help. And it was like God said to me, there you are. I've been waiting for you. I've been waiting for you, Peter. Come on. And somehow I got into a rehab in the UK. I went there on the 1st of October, 2001. And I was stoned out of my mind when I got there. And it was a dirty rehab. It was all prisoners. I was the only private client. And it was just what I needed. God gave me just what I needed. I became friends with criminals. I became with them. And I found that in a situation in a 12-step fellowship, amongst other addicts, something magical happens. And I didn't use for 6 days after I was gone because I was detoxed for 30 days. And then I got sober for 90 days, came back to Hong Kong, and I was in a terrible state because no one would talk to me. I'd lost my support group. I'd lost everything. And I thought, I got to get into this. So I went to an AA meeting in Hong Kong on the 1st of January, 2002. And I thought, I'm going for this. I am really going for this. And I traveled everywhere to conventions. And, you know, it's pretty cheap to travel to conventions when you're spending 500 US a day on drugs and suddenly you're not spending it anymore. I'd lost so much money and I started again. And during these trips, I found that there was a certain amount of joy. And there was something that I never knew about what life should really be about. And I started to think of other people. And my bank manager said to me one day, did you hear about this man who died and there were 2,000 people outside the church for the service when he died? No one knew who they were. And they were all people that he had helped and told no one. Mm. And I said to the bank manager, my God, oh God, I like, oh, that's fabulous. And then my voice said, why don't you do something about it? And then the next voice said, don't get $5,000 or something like that. It means nothing. It's a widow's mite. Do something that's going to hurt. Do something that's going to make you think, oh, you've got to force it out of you because it's so much money that you don't know if you can survive. And I thought, okay, so I met this priest and I spoke to him and he was running a thing called Full Circle. And I said to the priest, I want to make a donation. And he says, that's lovely for you. How much? So I said, 1 million. And he said, what? Why? And I said, because it hurts, because it means something. And if you don't, if you, easy, it's 5,000 here, 5,000 there. It doesn't hurt, it doesn't mean much. So I did. And I got so much joy out of that. I mean, I think it was early 2000s, I went to Tucson, and I went to a convention, and Laurie was there, and she blew my mind when she spoke. You know, she just blew me out of the water. And I said to a mutual friend, I must meet my woman. And my mutual friend, Dr. Lindsay, I want to meet her to talk to her about the team project. And we didn't connect for 2 days. And I kept saying to the woman, I want to meet Laurie. And I didn't think, I think maybe Laurie thinks I'm a stalker. Maybe thinks, I don't know what she thinks. I finally met Laurie, and we had a chat, and I made a donation. And we got to know each other, and I thought it was the UK. You know, I asked the UK to get you to speak at a convention. And we started going to fishing. Everywhere we went to the conventions, Laurie and I sat together, and people were really jealous of me because Laurie's a star, you know. Sorry, you going out with her? I say, never mind what I've got with this, Laurie. It's something spiritual. And it was magical. And then one day I thought, I'm going to leave people money in my will. And then I met Laurie in Montreal at a convention. And I thought, hey, Laurie, how's it going? We had our chat, and it was just us in this big kind of lobby area. And I said, I'm going to leave you something in my will. And Laurie said, oh, thanks a lot. And then I looked at Laurie and I said, could you give me a moment? And I walked over to a corner in that lobby, sat down and thought, what are you going to do? You're going to wait till you're dead? Why can't you do it now? Why can't you get some joy and give Laurie the money now? So I went back and I said to Laurie, okay, Laurie, I'm going to give you $1 million. And Laurie looked at me and a few tears. And I said, don't cry, I don't want to cry, I'm a man, I'm a big Englishman. But then it all happened. George was there, and it was just, and the joy that I felt about helping other people, I've never experienced joy like it. It was more kick to me than any drug I ever took. And I just felt great, you know, and I tried not to tell other people because, you know, I'm not by nature a man of humility, but I try my best to keep my head on the ground. I come from a time, you know, a slum, and I come from $15 a week, and I never forget that. And the wonderful thing is when we opened it, Laurie said, what should we call it? And they named it after my mum. Era Sanctuary. And I just thought, geez, this is incredible. And we went to a big kind of opening there, and I had the time of my life meeting the people. And so through people like Laurie, people like so many other people I've met, have made my life worth something, made my life meaningful, something I never ever believed I could get involved in, because I never ever believed I could make any money. And when I did make the money, I didn't think about anybody else. But the point really is, I'm 78 years old, I've made some money. It's not enormous by billionaire standards and by professional sportsmen, but I've made my pile, and I want to die broke. I want to die, because what's the point in having money if you don't spend it? And my bank manager told me there are enough people in his bank that have millions and millions of dollars that are still working. And when they die, they've left no instructions for the money. So it has to stay in the bank. The bank can't release it because it's not theirs. So you've got millions and billions of dollars gathering dust. And I don't want my hundreds of thousands and maybe millions of dollars gathering dust. I don't want that. It doesn't hurt me in any way. I don't give up the way I travel. You know, I'm a big nose now. I travel club, baby. I do what I want in my life. But the rest is easy. You know, I'm richer than Bill Gates because of people like Laurie.
That's one of the things that I think I'm so amazed by, the story and how the two of you found each other. You both had horrific childhoods. When you really compare it to the rest of the world, you really went through some very tough stuff, but you both found fulfillment and purpose to help others. So you both have made a conscious decision to say, hey, I'm going to help people who are like me in that position. And you turned the narrative around, right? It was, you know, Peter, you said people told you were stupid and you believed it, right? But then you finally learned that wasn't true at all. And Laura, you were, like many people in the foster system, kind of forgotten. You aged out, and then what happens, right? But you guys both made a conscious decision to say, you know what, I'm going to take this and I'm going to make something good out of it. And that to me is so inspiring and just so incredible. And Laura, you always say this too, that you were being prepared for your life. Like you had to go through that in order to be prepared. Speak more to that.
Yeah. And I also want to say, as much as Peter and I think I always say to Peter, whenever Peter would come to me and say, Lori, I'm going to, I would always say, Peter, from God's mouth to your ears, I don't even know how this happens, because whenever we were in a spot, Peter would come and do that. And as I want to finish this story, that the investor had the property and I went to see Peter, and then Peter told me that he was giving me the money from his will. And I was so excited that I returned home and I started telling the employees, my charity has gotten so big. We have 100 beds around at that time. And I told my chief operating officer, we need to find a place. Peter wants to give us money for a place. He doesn't want to spend it on operational. We have to buy a new place. So we started thinking about getting a place. And then that investor called me and he said, Lori, that property, I'm Greg. I just bought that big Boys Town property. I said, no, Greg, believe me, I already know who you are. You're the guy that snatched it out from under the foster kids. I'm stalking you right now. I know who you are. He said, it's 80 acres. I said, I know. And he said, but I only need 65 acres. Mm-hmm. And the 15 acres where the children sit, I'm going to donate that back to a charity. And I have 26 charities bidding on it. And I looked at your tax return and you guys are tiny. I don't even know if you'll be able to compete, but I like what you do and I want you to compete. And I thought about it. This was nighttime after I was home from seeing Peter and home from the trip and the money was in the bank. And I said, you know what, Greg, I can't compete with those big people like Olive Crest Orange. But these are all these big, they might have $90 million in the bank and I have two. So forget it. I said, give it to Olive Crest. And he said, are you sure? And I said, yeah, I don't want to go through all this paperwork just to find out some other big place got it. And I like the Olive Crest people. So he said, okay. And then I got into bed and George said, Peter just gave you $1 million. Maybe Peter would want Boys Town, right? So this is my childhood dream and I'm scared to try and I'm scared not to try. So I sat in my bed because we have different time zones and I texted him on Messenger, Peter, there's a place called Boys Town, because I figured they don't know about Boys Town in China, all right, or the UK. And there's a place called Boys Town, there's a movie on it and da-da-da-da-da and this beautiful site and you know, you wanted me to get something with your million, but at the Boys Town property, it's only going to be a down payment. And I said, but I like to find out what you think before I make a decision. So I woke up in the morning to a new text and it said, George thinks it's a good idea. And he's smoking a cigar right now. And Spencer Tracy thinks it's a great idea. And Spencer Tracy played Father Flanagan in the Boys Town movie. At that point, I realized, oh, I guess they do see Boys Town over there on the other side of the world. So I called the guy back and I said, I'm going to apply. And he said, I'm very glad. And I said, can we come up and see the homes? I want to see the state they're in. And I came up with a bunch of volunteers and I stood there and I told him, I have been obsessed with Boys Town. If you read my emails, my first place was supposed to be a Boys Town. I knew the parents that lived here. He was so touched. He called me the next day. He said, Lori, the investors are looking for someone with a lot of money and a lot of history, and you're not the top of the pile right now. He said, but secretly, if you can get me a loan letter by Friday, I'm going to make sure you get the property. So I called the first place we ever bought a house from, and I said, if you can get me a loan letter by Friday, and you got to understand, you can't get a loan letter in 2 months in these days and age. But they said they'd love to have Boys Town on their balance sheet. So they said, we're going to try it. And lo and behold, they had this letter by Friday, and we went through escrow, and I was scared to death. And we got the property. And then when I called Peter and I was like, oh my God, we got the property. You have to see it because you can't imagine what this property is like until you see it. And he came up and saw it. And I said, I want to name it Peter's property or something like that. And he said, no, Lori, I'm not doing that. And I don't want any part of that. Just I want to do it privately, like secretly. And then he went home and I thought, Peter's mom, if we could make this in honor of Peter's mom, not only would it be great for Peter, but it's also the honor of a woman who was like the perfect mom, which is what all these children up here need. Mm. So I texted him back, can we name it after your mom? And it gives me chills right now. I always feel chills when people connect to me from the other side, probably, you know, Peter's mom feeling us right now, talking about her. But yeah, so we named it after Peter's mom. And I got to tell you, the grounds that that place sits on are magical. Just to give you an idea, when we first went up there, I said, oh my God, we decided we would help girls that are victims of human trafficking like me. Mm-hmm. So we have children's homes for girls that are victims under 18. We have the only drug treatment for children in our entire county up there. That just happened. All the drug treatments in our county closed. And we just opened the first one in for children. So we're the only one. And we have girls that are over 18 that are homeless. And so I knew it was scary up there in the canyon without a gate because pimps or anybody could drive in. So I Googled gate company. I found this big gate company that says apartment gates. I don't know what they cost. So I hit them up on their messenger and I said, we got this place called Vera Sanctuary for foster kids and we need to protect them with a gate. I don't know what your gates cost, but can you please give me an estimate? And the man that owned the company said, can I meet you on site tomorrow? And I said, okay, got me right back. And I met him on site and he said, I have one question for you. I said, what's the question? He said, how did you know I was a foster kid?
Wow.
And I said, he gives me chills again. I'm like, I had no idea you were a foster kid. I saw a gate company and I called you. And he said, we're going to donate a gate. We're going to put VSW on it for Vera Sanctuary for Women, a big logo. We're going to get cameras. We're going to get video. You're going to have an app on your phone. We're going to make this the best security you've ever had. And then when we opened the children's home, one of the counselors came in and she was crying. She was new. And she said, I said, what's the matter? She said, this place reminds me of a little girl that I took care of when I was young. Her mom was my best friend and she's from Mexico and she gave birth to her and she ended up in the foster care system and she's somewhere in the Midwest right now. She's in a really bad state. And I see the girls we're bringing in. I only wish we could do this for her. And we talked about it for a minute and then she went back to our desk because we were taking an intake that afternoon and she came out screaming out of her office and I said, what's the matter? And she said, she's here. She's the one we're intaking today. I'm like, what do you mean? I thought she was in the Midwest. She said, I can't explain what happened, but she's coming today.
Wow.
This girl that I knew when she was a child that I've been praying for. I mean, the craziest, craziest stories. And the house that I work in is called Peter's Palace. We slipped that one in under the rug because they're under the wire. So that, but today I was having network problems and I'm like, the darn network isn't working. And then I saw, oh, Peter's Palace wireless. Oh, okay. I'll connect to that. Boom, I'm on. So, and it's crazy. And so this past year I decided, you know what? We could pick up kids from the street for the rest of our lives. And after my life, you just hope someone continues to do it. I'm constantly telling the girls you need to continue after me. But I don't want there always to be kids on the street. Mm. And since my background is in technology, I created something like a hotels.com. It's brand new. It hasn't released yet. We're going to give an exclusive to a big magazine over Christmas. But literally, you pull it up and it has beds that are available. There are no beds that aren't available. Only the available beds are there. And you click reserve and you will reserve yourself a bed. Because right now, when you're homeless on the street, you will call places all day long, every day. And there'll be waiting lists and interview processes. And that girl isn't here right now. Or it'll go to voicemail. And kids are dying on the street. I mean, I can literally tell you the table of pictures we have of the kids that have died has gotten too small. And we had to get a bigger table. It's not okay anymore. So I'm tired of treating the wounded and I want to end the war. So I worked on this system and somehow Microsoft found out. And they called me about a month ago and they said, this thing you're creating has never been done before for foster kids, for homeless people, for victims. And I said, I know it's never been done before. And they said, we want to partner with you on it. Wow. So Microsoft is going to be in the news, and they're building it bigger and better. They have my code and they're making it bigger and better. And we'll release in the next couple of months, I guess around Christmas or January, you'll see it and it'll come out and it'll be the first system ever. And my plan is to change the laws also that make foster kids homeless for Peter and I, like, kids like us, when they go homeless in the United States, there is no Amber Alert. There is no Amber Alert, right, which is a thing, I don't know if Peter knows, that comes to your phone when a child's missing.
Yep.
For foster kids, don't get Amber Alerts. There's nothing for a foster child. It's dead silent. And if they did turn on the Amber Alerts for foster children, your phone would never be quiet. It would ding all damn day long, because that's how many kids are missing from the foster care system. Mm. And that's why 60% of trafficking victims are from foster care. And I'm sick of it. I'm sick of it to a level that we're going to make new legislation. And I've been looking at it, and there was a lady in Arizona, right where Peter and I met, that just released a law about 10 days ago, where the social services has to report how many children are missing. And I'm going to have a call with her, and I'm going to find out how she did it. And we're going to replicate that law, so that, because I believe there are millions of kids missing and nobody's looking for them, and they're just casualties right now. And I don't want to leave this place. I know my people say I've still got some time on my hands, but who knows, right? I don't want to leave this place the same way with kids ending up on the street. I have to make a dent in this thing, and I have to leave it better, or I'm never going to feel peace in my heart. So we're changing the laws that allow the foster kids to go homeless at 18 and not get any money to help them, and that keep people from looking at them when they're looking for them when they're younger than 18. And we're going to get the bed system out there. And one more thing I told Peter, there's this other property and we haven't gotten it yet, so just keep it in your mind and prayers. It's an old boys jail. It's about 7 miles past Vera's Sanctuary, and it's empty, and it has 100 beds in it. And it could be a safe site for kids that were victims. Bad people are looking for them. And I was looking at the history of the property. It's at least 100 acres. I can't remember, maybe 130 acres. And it's huge. And I was reading the history, and it said it was bought for, it's got to be worth millions, but it was bought for $30,000 in like the, I don't know if it was the 1800s or the 1900s. And a man bought it for his daughter, Vera. And I thought, holy moly, I know it's ours. We just haven't gotten it yet.
Right.
I'm going to work it through. But so many good things happening. And every time I think George has completed all of his assignments and we're good to go and we're saving enough kids, another one plops down on my desk and I go, okay, I guess we're doing something else, guys. So we're going to keep on going and keep on growing it and hopefully divert the system that keeps them going to the street, Peter and I together. And I, although we've listened to God, both Peter and I, and I believe God will be laughing when we meet him and say, hey, I planned this whole thing. Don't think you're so creative. I put you both here. Okay. I think it's because we've gotten sober and our spirit and our mind is so clear that we can now hear the voice of God, that we've connected to each other, and together God put the two broken children together to save the rest of them. And I love that.
Absolutely love that.
Love you, Peter. We are just a dynamic team together that in the beginning, everyone would have thought, well, when I got Boys Town, it was printed in the paper, the worst kid we ever had in our county got the place. So that's how it ended up. Yeah.
It's such a beautiful story. And like I said, it is no accident that the two of you have ended up, that your lives intersected in the way that they did. And I'm so appreciative that both of you do what you do. And this, I mean, we do this Her Journey Told podcast because we want to tell the stories of people that inspire others. And I am like just blown away by the fortitude that both of you have. And Peter, I'm thankful that you are willing now to not just hide in the background, but to inspire others by your own story and getting them to also find a way. I mean, that's how you found your true joy, was giving away your money. Would you have ever thought when you were a kid that you would find true joy in giving away money when you were desperate and didn't have any? I mean, it's just such an incredible story. And I think that there's such a huge need in this world. And you both are just at the root of solving some of the world's biggest problems. And I just commend you both. So Lori, tell us, how can people, if someone's interested and want to learn more about Teen Project, how can they do that? How can they donate?
The best way to do it is just go to the website. And I know when I came up with the name, I didn't think about this, but when I say the Teen Project, some people think I'm saying it like a team of people, but it's teenagers. So right. It's the Teen, like double E-N, the Teen Project, because it's a project that helps teenagers. So if you go to theteenproject.com and you can see all of our press out there, you can go to the donate page. We're also taking crypto now because we're trying to be current with everything. So whether you want to donate cash or you want to donate some cryptocurrency, we would be so absolutely grateful because we have so much that we're doing right now. And we're really trying to end the war on abused children and children from foster care.
Absolutely. And it's such a huge problem. And I think sometimes we live in our little bubble and we forget that it really does exist and it's going on every single day all around the world. Yeah. So kudos to you guys for continuing to tell that story and driving that awareness. So thank you. Thank you so much. Yes.
Thank you, Peter. I hope I'm going to see you soon, Peter. Getting you out of there.
I will soon. Yeah. It's been a great experience. There's one thing, Sandy, which I could offer. I watched this thing on Netflix about losers. And this guy became world champion of the world heavyweight boxer by complete fluke. Then his next title bout, he got beaten up, and he was called a loser, a bum, and nothing else. And he said that's the best thing that ever happened to him, because he started to look for the kids on the streets and he started to make a difference. And strange to say, one of the best things that ever happened to people, like I'll include Laurie if she doesn't mind, I was a drug addict. I went from fame to shame. I hit the bottom. And from that, a new perspective in my life. It was then I found out there is a solution. You can recover from this and you can do something good. And so the best thing that ever happened to me, really, in some ways, is that I did drugs and that I fell from grace and I hit the bottom. Because without that, the avenue would never been open for me to change. So look after the drug addicts, look after the kids, because we got potential.
That's right. Yeah. Everyone's important, right? Every single person has an opportunity to contribute. Sometimes they just need a little help, right? And you guys are such a great example of that, of how you've come together as a community for each other and built what you've built. So
I really think, you know, in the beginning, how I said God hated me, and I always share this. Now I believe he loved me so much that he prepared me for what he wanted me to do. And Peter and I were both put on the path and then brought back out of it. And he said, now what are you going to do with it? And he got the two hellions, right? So we're not going to leave it as it is. We're going to fix it.
And it's such a great narrative. It's something that we all can learn from, right? Because oftentimes, yeah, I think when we face challenges in our lives, we think, oh, woe is me. And, you know, you let it start to define you. But you're saying let it define you in a positive way and let it inspire you to do good and help others. And I just think that is such a beautiful story.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having us on. I love
definitely, this. Definitely. Wonderful. Well, I'm humbled to have you both. And I know our audience is going to be inspired by this story. So thank you for being here. And you've been listening to the Her Journey Told podcast, brought to you by Pivotal Moments Media. And please listen, tune in for upcoming episodes. Thanks and have a good day. You've been listening to the Her Journey Told podcast, powered by Pivotal Moments. For more inspirational content, go to pivotalmoments.org. I'm Sandy Lutton. Thanks so much for joining us. Make sure to keep an eye out for more episodes where podcasts can be heard. See you next time.